Attention Ontario pickleball players. The Maple Leaf Pickleball Club invites you to the Smash for a Cause charity tournament in support of Jumpstart Charities. This action-packed day of competition and community spirit takes place at the Fairgrounds Racquet Club in Hamilton, Ontario, Sunday, April 26th. Whether you're playing for fun or for the podium, there are prizes to be won. And don't miss the battle for the coveted Maple Leaf Cup. Smash for a Cause. Register now at MapleLeafPickleball.org. That's MapleLeafPickleball.org.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit KimPurcell.ca today for more information.
Good evening, it's 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Henry Walker, and Juliana Gonsalves. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie. Let's start off with your local news headlines. The Kingston Climate Summit is returning this summer, bigger and more ambitious than its inaugural year. Presented by Sustainable Kingston, ICLEI Canada, and the city, last year's event brought together community members for a full day of panels, workshops, and conversations focused on local climate solutions. Now, organizers are building on that momentum. The 2026 summit expands to a two-day event. This year's summit, themed Shaping Our Future Together, will take place June 3rd and 4th at St. Lawrence College. Julia Stroud, Executive Director of Sustainable Kingston, sat down with CFRC to share what's in store. Well, to start us off, the summit is expanding to 2 days in only its second year. I was wondering if you could speak to what came out of that first event that made you go, we've got something here that we need to build on.
Yeah, so we had a fabulous time last year, and I will add that actually it was just a week before I started in this role, but I was able to attend as a community member, and it was just this fascinating mix of people coming together who are working in the field as well as interested community members, and it was a mix of speakers and workshops and tours, and so we've been able to add an extra half day, so that will expand the speaker section. But we're also going to have the tours again. Last year, the tours were focused on getting active with transportation, food farming and forests, and climate action across Kingston. So we're still working on the themes for this year, but they were a lot of fun last year. And so I know a few people have already said that they're really excited that it'll be offered again.
Awesome. And you mentioned there's going to be some more room for speakers this year. I was wondering if you could expand upon what this expansion makes room for in terms of both the programming and the overall experience.
So with expanding the speakers, we'll just have a little bit more room to delve into a few subject areas. So the overall theme for the summit this year is biodiversity. So that you might have started noticing that everywhere. That seems to be the theme across Canada and a lot of other countries as well. And so we'll delve into that in a couple of areas, both within the speakers and also within the workshops themselves.
Awesome. And how are we kind of building on this momentum from last year?
Well, I mean, that event last year came together quite quickly, and it had great attendance, and so I think we'll expand a little bit more into other parts of Kingston, but also the region as well.
And the theme is Shaping Our Future Together. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to what that means for Kingston right now, and why it's so important for community members to get involved in this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's particularly important because, as I mentioned, the theme that's emerging is biodiversity. And biodiversity is not only really important because that's what we're finding is, you know, it can reduce species loss. It can also be a sink for emissions. But it's also, it's visible, it's fun, right? It's something you can do on your own property or your business. It's something you can see. And so I think that's quite exciting because a lot of climate action can be quite frankly, a little bit sad. You know, it's always the things are getting worse, things are getting worse. Well, biodiversity is actually really helpful. All the other work is also super important, but biodiversity is something that people can actively do and every little bit counts. And so it's quite an exciting area to be expanding into.
Again, you mentioned there, we're talking about biodiversity this year. What are some of the biggest climate priorities and challenges facing Kingston that we may see addressed in the programming this year?
Yeah, so Kingston has actually started on its biodiversity action plan, and so that is a process that will take a number of months, but obviously highly relevant here. It also just finalized its adaptation and resilience plan, so that came out a month ago, and so that's available online for anybody to take a look. And so it'll be continuing those same themes, you know, how can we become more resilient as a community, which again, everybody plays a part in that, both larger organizations, the government, as well as individuals.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak to a bit what the audience for this looked like last year and who you're hoping comes out this year.
Yes, so last year it was a good mix of community members and people working in the field. So, you know, people in small nonprofits or Queen's University, the city itself. This year we're hoping to see all those same people, plus a few more, really. I think it would be great to see people from lots of different fields, just because this is relevant for all of us. So it's partly just people working in the field, but also for other community members and other organizations to kind of see themselves in climate work, because we all can do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had any goals this year. What will success look like for this year's summit?
I think success will look like expanded partnership. So that's the other aspect that we're delving into. So there's the Kingston Climate Partnership, which is new. It was announced at the last summit, and we'll be talking a little bit about what we've accomplished over the year, what we're working on. And if that grows and connections are made, you know, someone from one organization meets someone from a different organization, they realize they have something they can work on, I mean, that would be amazing.
Awesome. And no spoilers, but I was wondering if you could give us maybe some of the stuff that you've been working on since last year's summit.
So the partnership has come together. We've signed on quite a number of organizations and we've formed working groups. So there are four working groups within the partnership. There's buildings and energy, biodiversity, food, and integrated mobility. And we've started meeting as groups with the idea that really we will find projects to work on. So this is partly knowledge sharing, but also just an opportunity to seriously advance climate action in the community.
Awesome. And how can folks learn more about this year's summit and get involved?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways. If you go on our website, which is sustainablekingston.com, there's the event page there, and also through the City of Kingston's page.
That was Julia Stroud, Executive Director of Sustainable Kingston, on this year's Kingston Climate Summit. Organizers say the full lineup, including keynote speakers, will be announced in the coming weeks. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Hello, you are listening to your Queen's Campus Beat, Queen's Campus News, here on CFRC 101.9 FM or online at cfrc.ca. I'm Henry. Queen's administration is undertaking a review of its internal budget model, as confirmed in early April. The review is intended to better align university spending with its long-term strategic priorities, including research growth and the institution's bicentennial vision. This comes amid broader financial pressure facing Ontario universities, including changes to tuition policy and provincial funding structures earlier this year. While specific outcomes for the review have not yet been announced, faculty and governance bodies, including the Senate, have already begun raising questions about how resources will be allocated across departments. The review is expected to continue into the next academic year. Turning to student governance, recent reporting from the Queen's Journal has highlighted ongoing concerns surrounding the Alma Mater Society's Clubs and Campus Affairs Commission, with issues raised both internally and externally. The concerns, originally reported in early April, include allegations of poor communication practices and inappropriate conduct within commission structures. These commissions play a central role in overseeing student clubs and campus programming, making their operations critical to student life on campus. The AMS, which is mandated to represent undergraduate students and provide services and programming, is now facing increased scrutiny as stakeholders call for improved transparency and accountability in decisions decision-making processes. As the academic year concludes, it remains unclear whether structural reforms will be implemented before the next student government cycle begins. Staying with student governance and finances, a separate investigation has identified a significant gap, approximately $800,000, between projected and actual revenues across AMS services. Among the contributing factors are underperforming service units, including campus retail and hospitality operations, such as the Queen's Pub, where sales have reportedly fallen short of expectations. The shortfall raises broader concerns about the sustainability of student-run services, particularly as rising operational costs and shifting student consumption patterns continue to affect revenue streams. With AMS services traditionally positioned as both a student amenity and experiential learning environment, the financial gap may prompt a reassessment of how these services are structured and funded moving forward. In other news, we turn to a national recognition for a Queen's student. On April 10th, 2026, Queen's University announced that a second-year commerce student had been named a co-winner at the 2026 NHL Innovation Competition. The competition, which brings together post-secondary students from across Canada, focuses on developing new technologies to improve fan engagement and the spectator experience. The Students Project, an app designed to enhance how fans interact with live hockey games, was selected from a competitive national field. While Queen's has increasingly emphasized entrepreneurship through programs in the Smith School of Business, this win reflects broader institutional efforts to position students within Canada's growing sports tech and digital innovation sector. University officials framed the award as part of a wider push to connect Queen's research and student developments with industry-facing applications, particularly in entertainment and data-driven fan experiences. Finally, in Queen's Kingston Community News, a feature published in early April highlights how street medicine programs are adapting care for Kingston's unhoused population. These initiatives focus on delivering healthcare directly to individuals who may not have stable housing or access to traditional medical facilities. Practitioners have emphasized that prescriptions and treatment plans are only effective when patients have a safe place to store medicine and maintain continuity of care. The program reflects a broader shift in public health approaches within mid-sized Canadian cities, where outreach-based models are increasingly used to address gaps in the healthcare system. Thank you for listening to your Queen's Campus Beat here on CFRC 101.9 FM. I've been your host, Henry, for the 2025-2026 fall-winter academic year, with this being my last broadcast for the term. News on CFRC will continue through the summer, and I hope that you will all tune back in come September. Thank you.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and I'm very pleased today to have in studio with me a veteran of the Queen's Women's Football Program, 4 years on the team, and a former CFRC volunteer as well. In the studio today, I have Claire Chow. Women's football, it's flag, but there is a physical component to it. I believe, like, offensive and defensive line, that's basically full contact, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, that's correct. So we play two different formats. The first one, the one that you're talking about, is contact flag football, and that is essentially the exact same rules as tackle football. The only difference is that there's no tackling, but, like, jamming 5 yards off the line is allowed. O-line, D-line is full contact. Yeah, a little crazy on that. And then the 5v5 format, which is the format that's going to be played in the Olympics, is no contact. However, there's still a little, you know, like little, it's like basketball, like no contact, but like there's a little bit of contact here and there.
It's not like, yeah, a full contact sport, but there's still going to be that incidental contact on a play-to-play basis. Speaking of the evolution of this Queen's women's football team, you guys do play, obviously, like two different formats, but I know there's like 5v5. I think there's 11v11. What are the full set of teams for Queen's women's football? And can you give us like a quick little update on how each of them did this last season?
Yeah, so this last season, our season for 5v5 started in the fall. And going into the tournament, our team was actually ranked last out of all of the teams. So there were two tiers, and we were ranked last, which was pretty tough for us because we were placed in the lower tier, so we had to really, like, fight our way up. So that season was great. We had two teams in that. We had the gold team and the blue team. The gold team and the blue team started in the bottom tier, and then on the first day of playoffs, we played, like, play-in, so, like, we beat the top B-tier teams, and then we move up to the A-tier. It was just really awesome to see the growth of our skill throughout the season. So we actually went undefeated that season, the gold team, and ended up winning the championship. And then our blue team, which is supposedly the B team,
right,
finished fourth in the province, which is incredible. They just they finished fourth in the province. They beat most of the other schools, like A teams. It was awesome. It was so, yeah, it was just really cool to see. And like the success of the program is really, really taken off.
And that I didn't know. So you're telling me that within, you know, the 5 years since it was actually incorporated as, you know, an official club.
Yeah.
You have not just one, but two teams that are ranked in the top five mm-hmm. provincially.
Yeah.
That's incredible development. And I know this is something that has been building slowly. Can you talk about how your team has kind of progressed during your time from your first year to now this year as one of the veteran players? Like, what does that development look like?
Yeah, in my first year, it was definitely always taken seriously. But as time has gone on, we've just progressively gotten like more opportunity to be taken seriously and play really hard. So in my first year, it was kind of a little bit more relaxed. You know, we were kind of still coming out of that recreational phase.
Right.
So we took it seriously, obviously, but, you know, it just wasn't, we didn't have like that edge yet.
Right.
So we kind of went through some things that season that kind of gave us a little bit of a chip on our shoulder. We ended up finishing third, I believe, that season, which is not bad at all. Like, not bad at all. That was in the 11v11 season.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that season, we had another 11v11 season, went through some more things, lost by 1 point to Western in the final. And that was, I think that's what really pushed us over the edge to become such an elite team. I think we needed to go through some adversity together.
Mm-hmm.
Year after that, 11v11, took it home, undefeated 11-0, pretty historical season for us. Year after that, this year, undefeated in the 5v5 season, undefeated in the 11v11 season, and then undefeated in the 5v5 spring season. Yeah, so we took that personally, I think.
So that adversity has really kind of motivated this program into something of a surprising powerhouse. I'm not going to say coming out of nowhere, but certainly
coming out of nowhere.
Humble beginnings to,
yeah, for sure.
Now on the precipice of, and I believe this is the first time in the program's history that you guys have made it to the national finals.
Yes, correct. Last year we didn't go to the tournament that would have qualified for us for it because it was like 1 or 2 weeks after the 11v11 season, which was the same this year, but like we just decided we needed to do it. We needed to put our best foot forward and like go for it because we know we have the talent for it, and clearly we do.
Claire, how can the people listening at home support the women's football journey to nationals in Regina?
The donation link up on our Instagram page. As it stands right now, the club is self-funded, which means all of our student athletes and our coaches are paying out of pocket for this trip, which is really difficult because we don't receive a ton of funding from Queens. However, we are still extremely grateful for everything they've given us.
Of course.
But yeah, it really does put a pretty big financial strain on a lot of our players. So something that people at home could do is donate if you're able, and if you're not able, keep sharing our story, pushing it towards other people who might be able. And yeah, we really appreciate truly everything we are given, or all the publicity we get and like all the support we receive. We're really truly grateful.
And that's Queens W Football on Instagram. Claire, before we wrap up, any final thoughts, anything else you want to tell the folks listening at home here?
Yeah, the team is just so grateful to be representing Kingston and Queens as a whole. It really truly has given us a home for the last couple of years of our university lives. Supporting women in sport, that's a big one. Our goal as a team is just to continue to inspire girls to, you know, chase their dreams, because we're kind of in a really male-dominated kind of niche of sport, and it's really awesome that we've made it here and we're able to keep pushing and keep inspiring those girls to do the same. So yeah, just really grateful for everything, really looking forward to the opportunity to compete at the highest level.
To learn more about the Queens women's football team, follow them on Instagram at QueensWFootball. Thank you again to Claire Chow for taking the time for this interview. This is your Environment Canada weather report for the week. We begin with Monday, April 20th. Daytime high of 5 degrees, feeling closer to 2. Mix of sun and cloud dropping down below 0 overnight with a low of minus 2. Tuesday, April 21st, a little bit warmer, daytime high of 7 degrees, feeling closer to 3, dropping down to 4 degrees overnight, and we'll have a mix of sun and cloud during the day. Wednesday, April 22nd, another sunny day in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 11, but it's actually going to feel 4 degrees warmer at 15. Overnight low of just 4. Thursday, April 23rd, 11 is your high, but like with Wednesday, it's going to feel like 15, and we drop down to 5 degrees overnight. Friday, April 24th. A beautiful, picture-perfect spring day. Daytime high of 15, feeling like 17, with lots of bright sunshine in the forecast. Saturday, April 25th, more rain in the forecast for Kingston. High of 15. It's going to be a little humid, though, feeling closer to 18, even with an 85% chance of precipitation. That rain will cool things off moving towards Sunday, April 26th, however. Daytime high of 11 degrees, feeling closer to 8 with a 60% chance of precipitation. And then moving into the start of next week, the final week of April, Monday, April 27th, daytime high of 11. Beautiful sunny day, feeling closer to 16 degrees, dropping down to 5 overnight. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. In terms of road closures, Queen to Barry is still closed to accommodate construction activity at 283 Queen Street. William and Johnson to Aberdeen is still closed to accommodate construction activity in the area. Starting April 20th, the City of Kingston and Utilities Kingston will begin reconstruction of Princess Street. This major infrastructure project includes upgrades to underground and above ground utilities, as well as improvements to enhance safety and comfort for pedestrians and cyclists. There is a short-term road closure on Cranbrook Street from Days Road to Lakeview Avenue, which started January 1st, 2026, and is expected to end June 27th, 2026. So make note of that if you're out Front Road way. And otherwise, that's it for the major road disruptions here in the City of Kingston. Drive safe, everybody.
This is Christina Laurie coming back in with some of K-Town's hottest events and concerts coming up this week. Starting with events, Monday, April 20th, kick off your week with karaoke at Timeout Bar at 6, followed by trivia at One Eye Jacks at 7, the Brass Pub at 7:45, and Something in the Water at 8. Tuesday, April 21st, the Kingston Public Market opens from 8:30 to 5 in Springer Market Square, and Euchre takes place at Daft Brewing at 7. Wednesday, April 22nd, board games start early at Something in the Water at 5, with more at the Royal Canadian Legion at 6, alongside karaoke at Timeout Bar at 6. Trivia at Daft Brewing begins at 7, and the Grad Club hosts karaoke at 8, followed by a drag and burlesque show at 8:30. Thursday, April 23rd, the Kingston Public Market returns from 8:30 to 5. In the evening, check out trivia at Riverhead at 7, drag bingo at Daft Brewing at 7, trivia at the Grad Club at 8, and music trivia at Something in the Water also at 8. Karaoke runs at Jersey's at 8:30 and The Buckle at 9, along with trivia at Queen's Pub at 9, and you can finish off the night with the Urban Music Social at La Vida Bistro Bar at 9:30. On Friday, April 24th, trivia takes place at Wild Wings Kingston at 7, with karaoke at Daft Brewing and The Buckle starting at 9. Saturday, April 25th, the Kingston Public Market is back from 8:30 to 5 in Springer Market Square. On Sunday, April 26th, the Memorial Center Farmers Market runs from 9 to 1, and you have karaoke at both The Merchant and The Toucan both starting at 9. Now getting into your concerts coming up this week. Monday, April 20th, the Morning Doves take the stage at Musiki at 8. Tuesday, April 21st, Tom's Toonstay Happy Hour Jam kicks off at the RCHA at 4. John and Chris perform at Timeout at 4, and there's an open mic at Musiki at 8. Wednesday, April 22nd, DJ Great White spins at Hotel Wolf Island starting at 4, followed by Sean McCullough at the Cove Inn at 5. And Jonathan Jones at the Bank Gastro Bar at 5:30. Thursday, April 23rd, Ron Leary performs at the Cove Inn at 5. Cantabile Choirs present The Hobbit at the Spire at 6. Paula Wood plays Timeout Bar at 6. Painted Moons hit the RCHA at 7. Oscar Evans performs at Hotel Wolf Island at 7:30. Men of the Deeps take the stage at the Kingston Grand Theater at 7:30. And Frank Ryan and Friends close out the night at the Toucan at 9:30. Friday, April 24th, Neil Carter plays the RCHA at 4. Mike Garvin performs at the Toucan at 5. And there's an open mic at Storington Lions Club at 5:30. Cantabile Choirs continue The Hobbit at the Spire at 6, followed by Jane Sibbery at the Broom Factory at 7:30. The night doesn't end there. Evening shows include Christopher Jackson at Caesar & Company, No Limits at Time Out, and $5 dates at the RCHA at 8, plus the LaSalle Causeway Swing Band at the Legion. Later night performances include Grace Scheel and guests at Hotel Wolf Island at 8:30, Gerald McGrath at Tiernanog at 9, and Rudy and Saddle Up at the Merchant and China Cat Riders at the Toucan at 10:30. Saturday, April 25th, if you're looking for a matinee, the Stairs play Spearhead Brewery at 2 p.m. and The Hobbit continues at the Spire at 3. In the evening, Ganspring Rock takes over the Thousand Islands Playhouse in Gananoque at 6:30. A Supertramp tribute hits the Kingston Grand Theater at 7:30, and multiple shows kick off at 8, including Nicholas Campbell and the Meter Cheaters at the Buckle, the Big Fat Horn Band at the RCHA, Django's Kitchen at Musiki, and the Mudlocks at Time Out. Late night sets include Squid Pistol at the Merchant at 10 and Sweet Pete and the Heat at the Toucan at 10:30. Sunday, April 26th, Chicken Pickin' takes place at the Coven at 1, alongside Tom Savage and Friends and the 20th Century Band at afternoon shows. The Hobbit returns to the Spire at 3, followed by Wildcard at Time Out at 4, and an evening lineup at the Toucan starting at 5. Once again, those were just a few events and concerts coming up this week. For more, check out the full calendars on CFRC.ca. Have an event or concert you'd like to add to our online and on-air calendar? Reach out today via CFRC.ca or at CFRC Music on Instagram using the link tree in our bio. Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and listen on the go, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada, the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, and the Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
Good day. You're tuned into Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and this is edition 313. On the broadcast this week, I'm going to be featuring a conversation with filmmaker Noam Gonick. Noam speaks about the recently launched documentary Parade, a film that looks at different arcs over time of queer movements across Canada. This is an important film that links histories of struggle within queer, trans, lesbian, gay, and LGBTQ communities in the present to movements, really thinking through the ways that important gains against repression and alienation and also the marginalization of queer communities, how the important gains that have been made are linked to collective struggle. I think this film shows important insights into this intergenerational struggle. This is a film that was shared and launched through the NFB, and I was really lucky to get a chance to speak with Noam about his project, Parade. So here's our conversation. Documenting queer history in Quebec and Canada could take many directions. This recent documentary, Noam, that you worked on, Parade, takes a particular direction in regards to highlighting what, you know, you could describe as sort of the social movement forces or grassroots forces, and also cultural workers and artists that really changed the political, social, and cultural landscape in Canada around queer struggles for liberation. I think that in this particular moment, talking about your film, which is also beautiful, is very important because there's been this sort of erosion of popular understanding of these shifts in understanding around identity as something that was a top-down process in terms of like corporations or state institutions adopting certain discourses, and we sort of lose an understanding of the sort of
grassroots history that your film speaks to. So that maybe we could start there. And if you could maybe just first start by also just situating us and introducing yourself a bit. Thank you so much.
Great. Well, my name is Noam Gonick, Winnipeg filmmaker. And yeah, I just this year released an NFB feature documentary called Parade. And yeah, you know, when you're making a film about a movement, you can take any number of approaches. And, you know, I think that when you're it's in selecting what goes in and what goes out that your politics really come to the foreground. So, you know, I look at what chapters we could have gone into that we didn't, and why. And when we showed the film with you at Cinema Politica last week, one of the good questions was, what happened to gay marriage in 2001, 2002? Why, you know, that one didn't make it to the cut. And it's true. We had certainly discussed it. It, you know, we were looking at queer milestones in Canada. And of course, that was a big milestone. But I guess I've always belonged to that ragtag group of queers who felt like maybe the movement took a detour with focusing so much on equal marriage. And so ultimately, when it came time to winnow it down to size, the film had to be a certain duration. Certain things just had to hit the floor. And literally, a lot of people's sacred cow was slaughtered in the edit suite, and we didn't talk about gay marriage in Canada at all. So I don't know if that really answers your question, but there are any number of films that could be made about the history of the struggle of the gay rights movement in Canada. And, you know, I hope that the things that we didn't talk about get their own movies, such as The Pussy Palace, which was a huge chapter and milestone, but really was I the right director to tell that particular story? Maybe not. And were there archival elements? So, you know, there were lots of factors mitigating what could come into the cut and what couldn't. You ask about social memory and the way that corporations have co-opted, you know, diversity. And I think that we looked at the film, Justine Pimlott, the producer, and myself, really as being that exercise for people whose history has not been taught to them, has been hidden. I don't know who's behind the conspiracy, but certainly within a generation, memory is lost. It could be because people died from pandemics. It could be because it's just not packageable in popular history. So that, you know, and it hasn't been, you know, introduced into the educational system, perhaps in a post-secondary level, but. So how do you pass on that intergenerational knowledge of how these milestones were achieved, how these rights were won, and put it in a popular medium like a documentary that's accessible, where you can really pass down that information, which might be very useful in the here and now, things that people did in the 60s and the 70s, 80s, every time the queer movement had to hit the streets. And it's certainly not taught internally or externally. So we wanted to correct that.
Well, there's a lot of branches in what you said. So maybe we could just highlight one by one some of the key points that you went over. So I'll just start with what you talked about, Noam, in terms of that decision to not focus on marriage equality. Maybe you could just look at that a bit more. And I obviously appreciated what you said about the idea that there can be many films about struggles, movements, identities, broadly speaking, the queer movement. So just underlining that, it's a very generous note from you. But maybe if you could talk particularly about that decision and then how it relates about to this idea that there is also an important kind of collective memory or social memory around there being an acknowledgement of the social movement element, right? You know, this could be extended to other questions in Canada, for example, like the grassroots movement that pushed for public health care, for example. We don't need to get into that. Whatever the question is, that if we're talking about major social shifts.
Well, one thing about our film Parade is that really it benefits from previous filmmakers, documentarians, also video artists, art filmmakers, and using those pre-existing films as archival materials to tell the story, because we filmed very little on our own. And, you know, looking at what the film and the queer filmmaking culture in Canada has been very rich, you know, going back to the 60s with David Sichter's Winter Kept Us Warm, a great Winnipeg filmmaker. So there were films about gay marriage and documentaries and television specials and whatnot. It is a very covered thing. And that was one thing we looked at. You know, Jim Egan, a fantastic queer activist from Canada, was the subject of an NFB documentary edited by Ricardo Acosta, who edited our film. So, you know, when we felt that things had been covered, and gay marriage certainly gets a lot of attention, we tried to, you know, tell stories that people didn't know that much about. How did the term two-spirit come into being in Winnipeg in 1990? Not everybody knows that story. You know, the founding of OLA, the Latino queer organization in Toronto that helped refugees come from Latin America. You know, so we did try to go off the beaten path and make a film about subjects that weren't, you know, as I said in my first answers, about passing on that knowledge that's kind of lost or hidden. So that's part of it. What was the second part of your question?
Well, I was just mentioning that. Thank you, Noam. I was just mentioning how if we think about the ways that societies change, the narrative is often shared in a top-down manner, you know, sort of state power making decisions, and that changes dynamics as opposed to all the small branches that you talked about. You just mentioned, Noam, the question of the framework of Two-Spirit and Winnipeg. I'd love if you could share a little bit more about that, too, in your response.
Yeah, well, I mean, another thing that we sought to do in the edit suite is try to decentralize the movement from Toronto, because, you know, the historical fact is that so many of these milestones occurred in Toronto and people moved there from all across Canada and started their lives there. So you'll have, you know, great activists like Ed Jackson from New Brunswick, but, you know, doing his entire adult life in Toronto. So he becomes a Toronto activist, not an East Coast activist. And so, you know, and we were really vexed, for instance, that the East Coast, we could, you know, try as we might, we couldn't find a sort of a unique bracing milestone from the Maritimes. But the radar was out for anything outside of the 416 area code. And, of course, Two-Spirit was very close to me here in the Treaty 1 territory. And, you know, I have been working with a lot of the activists who were part of that gathering outside of Winnipeg and Beauséjour in 1990. I've done several films with them, both scripted and documentary. So it was dear to my heart. But even though, you know, I grew up with these people like Connie Moresti, I wasn't at the 1990 gathering, and so I got to learn a lot about how that all came together, and Myra Laramie's vision, and they're very generous with sharing that story. And we got footage from an American documentary filmmaker, Greg Jezerik, who was at that gathering, and we got his outtakes and footage from his film. And, you know, like so many other chapters, we were able to build it based on the filmmakers who had been there before me. So, yeah, people have said that chapter is very special because they can feel that kind of Manitoba spirit in it. And it's true. I mean, I just love it. I love the way it was cut and that the way the story is told. And, you know, with over 40 different storytellers in this documentary telling their, you know, first person accounts. Every chapter has its own cadence because of the backgrounds of the people who are involved in it. And the Two-Spirit one is just like very, very special and dear to my heart.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate, Noam, the way that you highlighted the nature of this film kind of as a tapestry piece, also drawing on the work of a bunch of different, not just filmmakers, but people with archival footage and materials from organizations. It also really speaks to sort of some of the more collective energy that is present in the sort of points that are highlighted in the film. So thank you for sharing that. Maybe going back to our first point of exchange and sort of the sort of broad-based relevance and importance of the film today, I'd love if we could sort of look into any sort of reflections you might have about the film today, because you know, it sort of brings up this question of the idea that, you know, society sort of stops after certain milestones or changes occur. But obviously, as we're seeing, you know, the rise of an extreme right, you know, the sort of discourse of the Conservative Party and Pierre Poilievre, etc., maybe not openly attacking queer communities, but in some ways, between the lines, definitely attacking trans communities. So different parts of the queer movement. I'd love to hear about your thoughts about the relevance of this work you did from your perspective today.
Yeah, well, certainly when the NFP approached me to do the project, and, you know, it goes back a ways, and, you know, I can remember thinking, okay, well, this won't be particularly controversial. It'll be interesting to, you know, the community. And, you know, of course, I'm interested in the topic, but, you know, is it going to be, you know, viscerally relevant to survival today? And I wasn't so sure. But then as the project progressed, it quickly became apparent that my assessment was wrong, and that these rights, which we thought were done and dusted, are very much in play. And everything is a lot more fragile than we would like to think. And it was really in trying to figure out how to incorporate the trans story, because, you know, as I say, the film is based on milestones, and so you look and try to find, like, what will be the milestone of the trans movement. And, you know, we looked at the first trans march in Toronto. It wasn't particularly compelling, but then we realized while we were in post-production that there was going to be an anti-trans march across Canada, the Million March for Children. So made the decision to, you know, although the entire film is archivally based, to actually pick up a camera or two, actually, and send two crews out into the Million March for Children and create, you know, new footage. And that would be the ending, the climax of the film, to show that, you know, and to do it, you know, the amazing part was we found still photos from the exact same sites in the early 70s where, you know, prior generations had, you know, protested and demanded their rights, gay rights. And then you see in front of the exact same pillars of the legislature here in Winnipeg, trans people, their supporters, allies looking to, you know, protect trans youth in a huge melee with a very right-wing populist group of anti-trans folk. And, you know, that protest happened coast to coast. And it certainly could happen again. So it really did, as you say, have sort of brought it into the here and now. And, you know, it wasn't so much about a stale history about how rights were won and, you know, everybody went to bed. It's something that is being litigated again today in the streets, and as Hugh says in the film, the backlash is upon us.
You just used the term litigated on the streets, or in the streets, excuse me. What does that mean to you, and how does it speak to the work?
I said that because the perspective of the film is that the streets give a movement its energy, and in the courts, it's somewhat depleted. So we really, although there were legal milestones, you know, and some of which we did discuss in the film, such as Quebec being the first jurisdiction in North America to enshrine gay rights in 1977, and that was a, you know, that was something that happened through legislation and also through the courts, and beating a police rap for the raid of the Trucks Bar. So the courts, you know, there's no denying that lawyers and those kinds of institutional organizations that, you know, fight in the courts are important. But from the perspective, I mean, our film is called Parade, so it's not about what happened before judges. But really, as Cyrus Marcus Ware says in the film, it's about stepping off the sidewalk and into the streets and connecting yourself to previous generations and that genealogy of resistance. And that there is something very metaphysical almost in, you know, if we can be woo-woo about it, about stepping off the sidewalk and causing, you know, automobile traffic to have to stop or wait and to actually occupy a street for a political cause. And it's really not until you do that, you know, if you don't do that, you maybe not, the needle, how should I say this, the needle might not move for you until you do that. And I think that's something that each of these chapters reminds us of. And it's not just about getting into the streets to cause ruckus and protests, although that's the key point. It's also to get into the streets to dance, to celebrate, to do die-ins, to do, I mean, any number of things that can be done in the streets to proclaim your love, to cruise, to, you know, all the other things that happened in the streets, in public. And I think that that is a lesson that the queer movement has to, you know, the broader social movement in the world. It's just something that, you know, you could find in any number of, you know, but I think because queer has that specific kind of its own magic, its own flavor, it has that kind of ribald celebratory element to it, the carnivalesque that I really wanted to make sure that we captured.
Thank you, Noam. That was very beautiful. If you could maybe just speak to maybe somebody who is interested in this film after hearing this conversation, or maybe somebody who might have come across it, like who's a teenager today, dealing with this political atmosphere in the present, what would you say to them, both about the film, but about the, you know, sort of major questions that the film brings forth around social change and celebration of culture? And, you know, you mentioned the sort of dynamics between, you know, taking the streets, but also celebration. You know, there's a lot there.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, because this is an NFB film and it's broadly available for free for all Canadians on the NFB website and app, and many other venues too. I think in this first 6 months of its release, almost 100,000 people have seen it. So I wonder, like, who are those teenagers from Nunavut, for instance, that, you know, have access to high-speed streaming or are all over the NFB website and watching this film, and what's their reaction? And, you know, I haven't had a lot of direct contact, audience contact, because in this new world, I mean, coming down to Cinema Politica last week was great, because I actually, it was a very university-aged audience, and, you know, their questions were amazing. The film, in the era of streaming, it just kind of goes out there into the world and people see it. And as the filmmaker, it's not the same as it was, say, perhaps 10 years ago or longer when, you know, you were out there very much in the fray with the audience in that moment of reception. Now things are just, you know, seen by individuals on their Paramount Plus or whatnot, and you don't really know how it all goes down or what their takeaway is. So I can't say for sure. I know you're not asking me what teenagers think of the film, but you're asking me what I would say to them. And I would say that, you know, we don't know if you, this next generation, are going to have to pick up the baton and really fight or get into the street and march for things that, you know, people in my generation felt we'd never have to ask for again. So it's funny, I being a product of Gen X, you know, was handed a lot of rights and came up in life in Canadian society feeling quite entitled. And for me, for my background, who my family and community were, wasn't particularly vexed about coming out. It wasn't that difficult. As you can imagine, it was kind of embraced. In Manitoba, gay rights were enshrined in my early teen years. I remember hearing about it, but, you know, we won it. The NDP put it in quite quickly. So all that is to say, I didn't really feel like, you know, certainly AIDS affected my generation quite heavily, but I didn't feel that we were a generation that really had to, like, pull up the cobblestones and, you know, run to the palace and burn it down the way that just generation before me did with the Operation Soap riots in Toronto, or like the generation after me might have to do now that this convoy reality is, like, here, and people are, you know, pushing back. The right wing is definitely pushing back, and, you know, gay marriage in the States was just, like, under the magnifying glass 2 weeks ago, and the Supreme Court could have decided to toss it out. This new generation is probably going to have a fight on its hands, and I guess that was really the motivation for Justine Pimlott, the producer, and myself, was to sort of create a guidebook or a manual for them to sort of say, you know, if these things fall apart, here's how they were won before. You might need to do this again. These are suggestions. You know, every era has its own context. What they did with We Demand in Ottawa in 1971 might not be what's needed in 2028 when something goes awry, but these are just the ways that these different milestones were played out. Learn your history, because it'll help you in the future.
Thanks so much, Noam, for the conversation today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was an interview with Noam Gonick, filmmaker based in Winnipeg, speaking about his film Parade, a look at the long arc of struggle of queer communities across Canada. This has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m., on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Thursdays at 8 a.m., on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. and Fridays at 1:30 p.m., on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m., on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m., on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m., on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m., on CJSF 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Tuesdays at 4 p.m., and on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Just look us up. Search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thank you for tuning in, and I will speak to you next week.
Hi, I'm Steve Swelsey-Wells, and I'm extraordinarily excited to invite you to Gannspring Rock 2026 on April the 25th at the Royal Theatre in Gananoque. Come rock out with MC Shansky, Gananoque's poet laureate Gretchen Huntley, and listen and dance to some great rocking grooves by Pudge, The Red Handed, and my band Triple J, all in support of the Gananoque and Area Food Bank. Advance tickets are available now for $20 through Eventbrite, or by emailing me at ganspringrock@gmail.com.